Good afternoon. So, as I mentioned at the end of the last lecture, most of today is going to be exam review, which is going to be about questions you have. First, I'm going to talk a little bit about what we did last time. So last time we mentioned that we had this idea of set user ID programs where we could make a program that does things that a particular user is allowed to do that normal users can't. So for example, we could have the program run as super user with this sort of bypassing most access control checks. And by setting up a program this way, assistant administrator, someone in that sort of role, could give users access to functionality they normally wouldn't have. So for example, we could let users restart the system even though the system call to restart the system ordinarily doesn't allow. And we could do this in a way that's very fine-grained because we can write a program that decides when it's going to restart, when it's not, and make some decision about when that's allowed that wouldn't be easy to tell the kernel to do itself. And this way lets the kernel kind of delegate those decisions to the system administrator. But we mentioned that, writing these set user ID programs is actually very hard to do securely because, the person running the program can run the program in a lot of strange ways that cause the program to behave incorrectly. Ways that you wouldn't normally think of because, they're ways that don't make sense to run programs. Because usually when someone's running your program, they're trying to get it to do the thing that you designed the program to do. But these set user ID programs need to worry about people trying to get it to do things that it wasn't designed to do. And if you aren't extremely careful, you can make mistakes in this. And one way you can make mistakes is that some things might seem like, functionality that does something, but it's not actually consistent. So we had the example of, there was this way of getting the current username. And that looked like, that just gets the current username. But it doesn't actually do that. It turns out the way it's implemented is it just retrieves a value that's stored in the current process, and an adversary could change that. And there's subtle things like that where you really have to understand sort of what interface you're working with to determine what things can I actually trust versus what things could someone running my program trying to fool it into doing things it's not supposed to do control. And related to this, we mentioned one thing that you might commonly want to do when you have this sort of delegating scenario is sort of do something on behalf of a less privileged user. And a common way you might think of doing this is checking if the user has access to something, then accessing that thing on their behalf. And this pattern runs into this problem known as a time of check to time of use vulnerability, where when we do the check, can you access this thing? And when we actually access what we think is the same thing, actually, there's a change in between. And that the thing we checked and the thing we're accessing are different. We saw this example with files, that we might check, is this file okay to access? And say, yes, it is. Then we access some file with the same name, but in between the time of the check and when we access the file, it turns out it's a different file, and one we're not supposed to let the user access. And we saw sort of one solution that POSIX had for this is that it lets set user ID programs sort of temporarily switch back to the user ID of who ran them, the less privileged user, in order to do things like open files and then switch back to the more privileged user to do the things that the user shouldn't be allowed to do. Then we said, we had access control lists, this sort of mechanism where we had sort of stored, sort of aside from our files or other things we wanted to control access to, who could access it. And there's this other model called capabilities, where rather than controlling what you can access as this sort of information that's on the side, we have these access tokens that indicate whether you have permission to access those. And POSIX kind of uses this for file descriptors. But to sort of make capabilities more general, we want to have this for not just open files, but also for how you open files in directories, how you access processes, and so on. And we also want some functionality of transferring the access tokens from one process to another. So rather than saying, here, access this file by this file name, we would say, here's a token to access the file, and that's how you get access to it. And this model is more attractive, at least to many kernel designers, than the sort of access control model, because the permissions check is exactly the token lookup. We say what the token corresponds to, that's going to implicitly check the permissions. That's where we check whether you can access the thing. And this means that it's harder to skip that check, and it's not really a separate step. And finally, we spent a bit of time talking about virtual machines. We mentioned virtual machines, we talked about system virtual machines, things that imitate real hardware, and we solved that sort of a basic strategy that doesn't require special hardware support. This is what we call trap and emulate. This is where we have an exception happen when the guest OS, the program that's running in our virtual machine, tries to do something, and we say, well, this exception on a normal OS, we would just kill the program and say, why did you try to do this operation that normal programs can do? But instead, what we'll do is we'll say, what would this operation do on a real machine? And we'll imitate that effect. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay. So I'm gonna collect things people want to know about the final. First, just a general thing. This is the current draft of the instructions to get rid of some common things. It's going to use the quiz system. We're asking that you show your work in the comments field. This is how we're going to give partial credit. If you don't do that, well, you're not getting partial credit. Most likely. It's a open. You can use any resource created before the exam opened, so notes, lecture recordings, etc., all okay. Like, don't ask questions on Stack Overflow from the exam. Don't look for other people who've done so, and other places where people might do that. But otherwise, yes, we're not going to try to have it be a closed notes exam with a 24-hour time limit. Don't think that's realistic. And it will be some combination of, you know, multiple choice questions, short answer like on the quiz, and there may be a couple longer answer questions. We will actually be doing more grading of human grading of this than we do for a typical quiz. Okay. And where's my window? Here. Okay. So with that done, what do thing people want to ask questions about for the final? Any things people want to go? Yes. So what topics may be covered? Okay. Other. Yes.
Like best ways to prepare for the final exam.
Yes. Okay. Someone over there. I thought I saw. Oh yes. Okay.
Is it open function?
Yes. Okay.
Like an overview of the default.
Okay. Do you have something more specific? I just ask because I worry that I will not be actually overviewing the part you care about if you just aren't more specific. Other questions? Yes. Okay. Yes. Kernel versus user. Okay. Yeah. Types, can we be, is something specific about that? Okay, just, I ask these things because I worry we will not cover the part you care about. And, yeah. Sorry? Okay, MMAP. Anything more specific? Okay. Yes. Okay. Okay. Anything more specific? So I have a bunch of logistics questions. We'll start with those. I'll sort these by where in the semester. What topics may be covered? I'm looking through the course schedule to construct the exam. So I'm just looking at the course schedule, trying to cover roughly evenly. Probably some topics on the schedule won't schedule, you know, even full days, perhaps, you know, can't make it for space. But that's what I'm looking at to construct the exam. I'm trying for a rough, approximately evenly distributed from weeks. But again, you know, there's only so much room in the exam, so some topics, like perhaps whole days of material will not appear, or maybe in whole weeks, but that's what I'm looking at when constructing the exam. So I'm just looking what was covered in every week and trying to like roughly evenly distribute for the weeks. Yes? Question, could I be asking about stuff from homeworks? Yes, I think there hasn't really been homeworks. We haven't talked a lot about a lot in lecture, so. Very definitely, right? We talked a bunch about FAT. We talked a bunch about copy on write in lecture. Talked a bunch about shells. So all those things, like, pretty natural. Yeah. Okay. Okay, ways to prepare. So under study materials on the website are past exams and quizzes. In most previous semesters, there was a midterm plus a final, and probably the exam will be a mix of a midterm and a final as far as what it covers. Final, we covered slightly different things than previous semesters. Some topics from previous semesters weren't covered this semester. Just be aware of that. But this is probably, if you want practice, that's probably the best sources of practice. Curve, the course policy, let me pull up the description. Says, so the exam, there will be, the exam score will be the raw score, you know, without adjustments, but overall course grades, I will do some determination after I have all the exam scores about whether what naturally maps to a 60% should actually be a D minus and so on. And I do this in a way where I say, what did a typical student who got a 60% do in the class? Is that really something I want to be only a D minus? And if not, I might move that threshold down lower than 60%. I won't move it higher. In past semesters, usually this has been a few points deduction, but on the other hand, in past semesters, usually the quiz average has been substantially lower. But I will look at overall grades after the exam. So if the exam's exceptionally hard, that will influence me to change the overall grade thing, but I won't do something on the exam. Open books, open notes, yes. That's why I showed the instructions. If it was yes, anything, yes. It's open book, open notes, yes, but individual, sort of no looking for questions asked after the exam was released. Length, I'm guessing it's probably equivalent to around 30 multiple choice questions. Making guesses as to what non-multiple choice questions are equivalent to, but that's sort of what I'm aiming for. With the assumption that if it takes you 5 minutes to do each multiple choice question, that's 2.5 hours. And 5 minutes per multiple choice question should be plenty of time, I hope. And format, so probably mostly multiple choice or short answer similar to quizzes, sort of small number of sort of write a few lines questions, probably mostly with like a couple lines of code or something like that. And generally, we'll expect work in the comments so we can give partial credit. Partial credit, which we'll look at much more than in typical quizzes. Questions on logistics issues? Yes?
How much X36 code would you expect to be in there?
How much X36 code will we expect to be in there? Not going to say. There could be X36 code there. It's an open book, open notes exam, so you can like look things up in X36 if you needed to. So thread versus process control block. So thread is sort of simulating a sort of virtual processor. And so it has its own registers. And that is registers, and this includes sort of PC and general purpose registers. So EAX, stack pointer, etc. And it has state related to scheduling. So this depends on the scheduler, but like, you know, e.g. if lottery scheduler, we'd have the ticket count would be assigned to a thread because that's the thing we schedule. You know, if CFS, it would have its virtual time. You know, whatever we need to track for scheduling, the thread is the thing we schedule, so we're going to have to track that state for a thread. And I guess more generally, like also, you know, is it running, runnable, waiting for something, waiting for I/O, etc. And I guess sort of in the XV6 design, it also has, you know, maybe a kernel stack. Typically, you would have one kernel stack per thread, so it has its own kernel stack. And a process is collection of threads, sort of virtual processors, plus memory. So we have, you know, one or more thread control blocks associated with the process. And we also have information about the memory layout. So this includes the page table. That's a process thing. And also, you know, any data about, you know, what's in the memory. So e.g. like a list of mmaps or where the end of the heap is. Whatever type of information we're using to track the logical thing that's in the memory, which depends on the details of what ROS implements. If we're doing Linux, it's basically a list of mmaps. If we're doing XP6, it's where the end of the heap is. That information is going to be tracked. There also we have sort of IO access. So this is going to be file descriptors on systems. It's all going to be part of the process. And I guess we also recently talked about access control and sort of user ID, group ID, etc. information would also be part of the process. File descriptors. What directory we're in. So questions? Thread versus process control block? Yeah. Question is, each thread have its own distinct user stack? Yes. That is not stored explicitly from the thread control block, because all the memory of the program sort of is going to be linked from the page table of the whole process. It's just that the stack pointer, you know, parameter will point to own stack, but all the stacks in the process will be in the same page table. So yes, they'll have their own stack, but they'll all be in the same page table. They'll all be allocated in the same process's address space. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, where are the user stacks located in the process's memory? If there's multiple of them, you mean? That is up to the OS to decide that. On Linux, like, the stacks that aren't the main stack are allocated kind of in the same area. We like malloc things. Does that answer your question? So, question in the heap area, something like the heap area, but that's not the only possible choice. It doesn't really matter as long as we put them somewhere, but we have a common memory for the whole process, so they're going to be somewhere in that process's memory. Does that answer your question? Other questions about threads versus process control blocks? Okay. So system calls generally. So one thing that system calls are, you know, asking the kernel to do something for it. The question is, why isn't the program just doing it itself? I guess this should be. And that's because some operations require kernel mode. So we should talk about kernel mode for that. So kernel mode is sort of the processor enforces that some things only special code can do. How do we know if code is special? We track an extra bit in the processor, which is, are we in kernel mode? We flip this bit on when we do things that should execute start the OS. The OS tells the processor to flip the bit to off when it runs normal program code. So if this is done properly, then the only thing that runs in kernel mode is the OS's code, not all the OS's code, but only the OS's code, and normal program code doesn't run in kernel mode. And what sort of sort of operations are reserved only for special code. So this includes handling, talking to I/O devices, handling exceptions, changing page table, base pointer, and things like that. So those are the sorts of operations the processor will reserve for only special code, where special code usually means the OS's code, because the OS will set things up so it always has this kernel mode bit flipped off when it starts any normal programs. Yes?
So does connect to network part of the IoT?
Sorry?
Is
connecting to a network talk part of talking to an IoT device? Yes. Okay, so we know it requires kernel mode. So system calls for the programs ask the kernel, which is the part of the OS which runs in kernel mode, to do something for it. And it can't do it itself because some operations require kernel mode. I guess I should mention the other thing that's special is that accessing memory marked in the page table as kernel only. So that's something the kernel often does, just deliberately, just restricts things to the kernel. And so how do system calls work? The program deliberately triggers an exception. And exception handlers always run in kernel mode. And what they do is set up by the OS only. So no one else can choose what the exception handler does but the OS. And the OS makes a decision that triggering an exception, certain exceptions in certain ways will make it do something on behalf of the program. Yes? Sorry? Well, it prevents the user from writing their own exception handlers, so handling exceptions, including setting the exception table pointer. So the user can't tell the processor where to put where the exception handlers are. That's reserved for kernel mode only code. And something like a calling convention, is chosen by the OS to have the program communicate what it wants the OS to do. So the OS will just decide on something like a calling convention, a way to pass arguments and what operation to do for system calls. And it will do it based on that. And that's how it knows what to do. It's just a decision the OS makes, and the program knows what decision the OS made, so it makes system calls in the way the OS expects. So other things about system calls? Yeah.
How does the processor know it's the OS bit that the OS code is running?
How does the processor know the OS code is running? We flip the bit on when we do things to start the OS, and most notably, handling an exception is assumed to run the OS. We also probably have the bit on when we boot. Question is the OS code that flips the bit? No, because we aren't allowed to flip the bit in user mode. It's when the processor runs code because of an exception, it flips the bit because it knows it's running the OS because that's who handles exceptions. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? About system calls and kernel versus user mode? Okay, so then pipes and file descriptors. Okay, so in the Unix design, every process has a table of file descriptors. And this table has index into table, and to index and table maps to a open file description. And system calls expect an index into the table when you ask to read or write a file. Also in the Unix design, files represent not just files on disk files, but also most devices, like keyboards, the screen, etc. And pipes or sockets, pipes and sockets that can communicate with other programs. These are all represented by files. Files provide the interface that we can interface, you know, read and write and close. They provide those operations. That's what we consider a file. And I guess there's a convention in the Unix design. Convention that file index 0 is standard in, index 1 is standard out, index 2 is standard error. That's just a convention that Unix has decided on rather than having us use numbers all the time. So then as for pipes, so a pipe is a special file where we write to it, write it, and then can read back what we wrote. And the pipe system call creates a new pipe, or library call, I should say, and gives us two file descriptors for it. One file descriptor allows us to write to read from the pipe only, and one file descriptor allows us to write to the pipe only. When we write to a pipe, the kernel will keep a small amount of written but not read data in memory. If it runs out of space, it just waits for someone to read to free up space. Yes? Is there a question? If you write to a pipe and it's out of space, is there something that tells you that? The default mechanism is that it just gonna hang. There is a way of making it not hang. We did not discuss that. But there is a way of doing that. It is just not something we discussed. But it's not the default setting. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions about pipes? File descriptors? Ask about, yes. I'm going to go through the questions I already collected, and then we'll see if we have time for another round. Okay, so then we had about CFS. So this is the completely fair scheduler. And sort of the idea is to give every thread and a fair amount of virtual time. And what is fair? Fair equals same after taking into account any weight assigned to the thread. So we assign a weight to the thread. Other than that, after we take that into account, every thread should have an equal amount of time. So how do we do that? So what we do is identify who is furthest away from having their fair share of virtual time and let them run. Let them run. I guess who you know, that can run now and let them run. And what is virtual time? Virtual time is basically equal to the amount of time you've run on the, you've had the CPU with adjustments for time you weren't runnable and possibly for your thread being more important than others, according to the system administrator. So the key decision we're making is we're saying who's furthest away, you know, who's furthest away from having used the amount of CPU time they're entitled to, we run them of the threads we can run. Questions? Yeah. Question, is it still possible to get more than your fair share from CFS by doing I/O? So provided that the sort of our definition of virtual time actually makes sense, no, right? So you're still gonna only get, you know, that you're only gonna get that amount of time provided other if someone else can run, they're gonna get the priority over you if they have had run less than you, right? So the question is, like, will doing a lot of I/O increase your priority? It generally won't, right? So in the design, like, you'll get credit for not having used the CPU. That's what you get credit for. You don't get credit for having given up the CPU to do, like, in multi-level feedback queues. You get credit for not having used the CPU for some actual amount of time. And so it's more resistant to that sort of gaming for that reason, because you have to actually not just, like, not been runnable for a while, you have to actually have not run for some amount of time to get credit for that time. Question, does it deal with programs that try to slow down the system of context switches? We didn't talk in detail about that part of what Linux does. But Linux has some policies it does to try to limit context switches, but CFS, sort of the basic idea of prioritizing virtual time, is not actually very good at, like, optimizing context switches in general. It's not, like, it doesn't make it exceptionally bad, but it's not something you want to, it's not, that's not a design goal. Does that answer your question? Okay. So, then we had copy-on-write MMAP. So copy-on-write means that we have, so normally we'd copy values, copy some part of memory, something, e.g., for example, when fork is called. There's other cases we've learned that it can happen. Instead, let's not copy it yet. Copy it until the last possible moment. So the question is, when is the last possible moment? moment. It's when that's when last possible moment, when someone tries to modify one of the copies. Before this, we can just use the original version and no one will notice. So the solution is set all the fake copies, the sort of pretend copies, as read-only if the processor complains that a program tried to access the read-only thing, then actually copy it. That was the basic copy and write it. And when we do the copy, we can copy as little as the page the program was trying to access. So we don't need to copy the whole thing, we can just copy one page at a time, and that's going to be enough, to do as little as possible. We could do more, maybe that's faster, but copying just one page is going to be enough to make things work and do things basically at the last possible moment. Delay the other copying until later. Questions on copy on write? Okay. So we had mmap. So mmap is make it appear that a file, like on disk, is part of your program's memory. And there's sort of two modes for mmap. So there's one is give you a private copy of the file. So basically, as if we copy the file into your, copy the file or part of the file into your memory. But we can actually implement this with copy on write. Another mode is give you a shared copy, shared access to the file. And this is going to be when you access your memory, it accesses the real file. How? The OS caches the file temporarily in memory and gives you direct access to the cache, to that cache, through your page table. Sort of, in both cases, just like the OS doesn't need to set the page table entries immediately, it can just remember where the mmap area of memory is, and set the page table entries when you try to use that area memory and the processor complains it's not set up yet. Questions about map? Yeah. Okay, so the question is, in the case where we have, so that's this issue with for the page cache. So we mentioned that is that we have cache cop is that we use keep files and program data sort of temporarily in memory, but they have a permanent location on disk. So for files, this is straightforward where the permanent location is. You know, for non-file data, we make up a location on disk. And probably for performance, we'd like to not use this location on, we'd like to use the location on disk not very often. And part of this is, this means we need to know, you know, when to save something from, we need to be able to remove something that's temporarily in memory from memory. And we have two cases. So one is the thing in memory is the same as on disk, in which case we just forget about the, we just, you know, change bookkeeping information to know it's not in memory anymore. The other case is the thing in memory is not the same as on disk. So there was some modification, in which case we need to first write the changes to the in memory to disk so we don't forget them. This implies we need to track if things in memory have changed, and how we do this is we have a when something is written, some page usually is written, we set a dirty bit to mark it as changed but not saved. Does that answer that question? Other? Then about set user ID. So set user ID is, so we have sort of normally when I run a program, it has the same access as any other program I run. Same access as the program that starts it and any other program. Sort of set user ID programs are ones where we want some programs to have extra access. Usually because the system administrator wants to have a way for users to do things that their normal programs can't, you know, can't, maybe shouldn't do. So example, if we want to let you sort of mount a, you know, attach, you know, load a USB stick, right? Normally, most programs aren't allowed to manipulate the file system. So normally, this requires, you know, normally restricted access to sort of file system calls. But normally the kernel won't allow you to do that. So we mark system administrator creates a program owned by privileged user, usually UID0, and marks it as set user ID. Then when the program is executed, the kernel records its user ID as the owner, usually 0, which implies that that program can access, can do things that a normal other programs we'd execute would not be able to do. Can't. And the system administrator needs to make sure that the program doesn't, you know, only does things that they are okay with. E.g., you know, maybe it lets you mount, you know, load USB sticks, but not change how the normal hard drives are configured. That would be something the programmer would be responsible for making sure it obeys those restrictions. Yes, question? So logging in as another user, yes, would be another sort of operation that we can't, in a normal program I run, can't do. But we could give you a program that lets you do that. Does that answer your question? Yeah. I am at the end of the list, so I will take a second round of questions from everyone. And we'll see what we have time for. Yes. Which is about?
Pthreads.
Okay. Other topics? Yes. This quiz? Okay. Which is about, what's the quest question about?
About the same user ID.
Okay, so user ID, okay. Yeah. Page replacement, can we be more specific or just generally? Policies, okay. Not the mechanics of doing the replacement, okay. That is helpful. Okay, other. On what? Okay, so I need to pull up the actual final. Anything else? Okay, 2020. Oh, I see. Okay, so I need to remember to link the 2021 final from the actual site. Okay. So, the 2021 final, which I need to link from the study materials page, question 12, is this what you were asking about? Yeah, quite.
I just wanted to add another thing that you were asking for.
I took the wrong questions, we'll do another afterwards. Okay, so. So in this question, we have we need to implement a call for set state, which sets a state to true or false, and wait for state, which waits for the state to be true or false, depending on what you pass in. So in what we want to do in set state is we want to see if we're changing the state, and if we are, we want to notify everyone, and we also want to return only after everyone has woken up. So we need to figure out how many people are waiting, so that's going to be presumably tracked in this waiting variable, and we're going to, while the number of people waiting is not too many, we're going to wait on this wait for done condition variable, which we were missing, as mentioned in the key, a actual const single for, but that's why they're comments. So once we have a const signal for that here, we want to wait while the number of done is not equal to the number total waiting, and we count the number of done, start the number of done waiting at zero, until after we set the state. And we also broadcast. We're broadcasting with the lock held, so that's just going to wake those threads up, but they aren't going to actually come out of this con wait here until we actually con wait ourselves, because the lock is still going to be held.
And yes, as I said, they were missing, there's missing a con broadcast here, which we definitely needed for bouncing. So that's 12. And then you were asking about, so the key thing here is that, you know, we want to set expect on to the number waiting, which has to be, which is incremented here. This is going to be a while loop because we always need to worry about spurious wake-ups, and we also needed, as not mentioned, a signal to the wait for done CV. And we need a broadcast to the wait for state CV, so these threads that were waiting and wait for state wake up. Questions about that? Yes. Why is the first broadcast relevant to the rest of the code? So the threads that are waiting in here are never going to get out of there unless we do something with wait for state CV.
So broadcast wakes up all of them?
Yep. Broadcast wakes up all of them. Okay, so then asking about question 13. So question 13 is asking about a deadlock scenario that occurs with this code. And it's saying that we have a copy all files in a directory, which takes a from and to directory. It goes through all the files in the from directory, and then copies that file to the to directory, getting locks as it does. And we mentioned that if we're copying from directories A to B, and also moving a file in the same directory, we can have a deadlock. And the problem is because here we lock the file and then its directory. And here we lock the directory and then its file. So we don't have a consistent lock order, and that's where the deadlock can happen. So we have a deadlock because we can have the directory lock held while we're getting the file lock in copy all files in, and we can have the file lock held while we're getting the directory lock in move file to directory. Questions about that? Yes. The file F is the file that's in directory A. Specified in what I have highlighted. And we're getting its lock here in move file to directory, and we're getting its lock here in copy all files in directory. So I will pthread, so this question, so note I need to link up the 2021 final to the study materials page. So the question here, so this was we need to broadcast to wake up from wait for state. Also need to wait for done to become high enough, and question was missing a con signal from wait for state to wake up the set state thread. And in this question was about deadlock, so let's just be threads. Deadlock, the deadlock was sort of inconsistent lock order, you know, copy all files and did lock directory, and then wait for file lock, and move file to directory, did lock file and wait for directory. question. Yes?
Can you explain line 162?
162, what? The question, the code in the question was missing a space to put a comm signal. Because we were doing, it was doing while done doesn't equal expect done, pthread con wait, there needs to be a con signal that wakes up this con wait. Thread from this con wait, otherwise it's just going to wait forever.
Wasn't there already a broadcast using
it? The broadcast was not on the same CPU. Yes. And it also was not at the right time to wake it up. But. Okay. So, the question about page replacement policies. So, with page replacement policies, so, like scheduling policies, we could have, there are multiple possible goals. I guess I should say, what are they generally? Page replacement policy is when we have pages cached in memory and need to free up some space, what do we stop caching? There are multiple possible goals. So we mostly talked about the goal of minimizing or sort of maximizing the hit rate, meaning minimizing the number of replacements we'd have to do. There are other goals we could have. You know, other goals would be like performance, sort of, I guess, fairness between programs, sort of overall performance, which is related to the hit rate, but not quite the same thing because replacing some pages might be more expensive than others. And there's possibly other ones we could think of. Typically, the optimal policy is optimal policy for maximize hit rate. Assuming we don't replace things, we only replace things when we only replace things just when we need to load something new. New is Belady's min, which is replace the thing accessed furthest in the future. Usually least recently used like policies are a good approximation of this, but there's no guarantee of that. That's just like an empirical property of programs that it works out that way, but there's nothing inherently true that has to make that case. But this means that we try to approximate LRU by monitoring accesses to pages and choosing things that weren't accessed recently. And there's a bunch of options for doing this, sort of multiple options for how to do this. And I guess, sort of as a side, you know, sort of extensions to this basic idea are that in addition, we can try to load pages before they're accessed. So an example was read ahead, you know, head of process accesses 1, 2, 3, then load 4, 5, 6. That's just a guess we can make. And we can try to have heuristics to detect specific access patterns, other specific access patterns. So an example of this was looking for accessing a file once and not using it again. We saw ways of trying to look for that specific pattern we knew was common just as a replacement policy ID. And we can imagine applying that to lots of other patterns we didn't discuss. So if you know there's a typical way a program accesses something, you can try to say, okay, looks like this, let's predict that. Yes? Question is about active and active list policy. So this was an example of approximating LRU. Example, sort of have active list of pages which were loaded more recently and inactive list of pages that were on the active list for too long, and check for accesses to pages on the inactive list. So that's just an approximation and sort of part, maybe sort of possible intuition for why to do this. It's not worth your time to check pages that were recently loaded are still being accessed. That answer your question? Question, if a page on the active list is accessed and doesn't move to talk, yeah, because we're just not checking for accesses to it. Right, and the sort of intuition behind that policy is that, well, I loaded it kind of recently, so why would I guess that it's gonna be something I want to like do anything with soon? Question, when a page is accessed on the inactive list, does it immediately go to the active list? So we had a question where I explicitly specified it worked that way. In actual Linux's implementation, it's a little more complicated. It goes to the active list probably soon, but it's not checked necessarily immediately. Does that answer your question? So you don't have to wait until it goes to the bottom? Yes, but it might not happen immediately when it's accessed. Other, okay, and then quiz 13, question 2, okay, which will, I thought I had a window for this, yes, okay, so quiz 13, question 2. So in quiz 13 question 2, we're asking what's true about set user ID programs, how they work. So remember when we run a program that set user ID, it runs as the user ID that owns it instead of normally when we run it, it would run as, you know, whatever user the program was starting it was at. You know, we just wouldn't change the user ID information when we executed the new program. We just keep it the same as it was before. So we have our options. So A, does it run in kernel mode? Generally, we don't run code that users supply to us in kernel mode. The only thing that runs in kernel mode are like system call handlers, parts of the OS. The program, even though it might have been set up by the system administrator, it's not part of the OS. At least not part of the kernel of the OS. It still runs as an Oracle program. Now, if it's running as user ID 0, then when it does make system calls, they're going to be handled differently than normal system calls in that when there's like an open call, we're going to say, are you allowed to open this file? Yes, because your user ID is 0. But that's just a difference in how system calls are handled. That doesn't mean it's running in kernel. And for B, it's only possible to start if one is logged into someone with administrator privileges. Whether you can start the program or not, that's controlled by the access control list, which is not tied to the set user ID bit. The set user ID bit is a different piece of information. And question option C was once started, maybe we'll perform operations that a program owned by user ID 0 and not works at user ID would not be able to do if started the same way. So if we start a normal program that's owned by user ID 0, it's going to run as the same user ID that we had before starting it. And as a classic example of this, if I run ls, ls runs with my user ID, even though ls is typically owned by user ID 0. It doesn't actually get the permissions of user ID 0, it runs with my permissions. So like it can't read directories I can't read with my normal programs. So set user ID programs are different than this policy. Because normally when you run a program, we don't care who owns the file that has the program. We're just going to run it with your permissions. And the final option, I messed up the phrasing here. Normally when user ID 0 runs a program, even if that program is owned by a normal user like me, it gets to run as user ID 0 and do all the extra things user ID 0 can do. So this means that if I am a system administrator and you fool me into running your program, you can do everything that I can do logged in from that program. So as a system administrator, you're supposed to be careful about what programs you run for that reason. So I believe the sort of main confusion was about the option C. So normally when we run a program, even if it's owned by the system administrator, it still runs with the same access that our normal programs have. An example is ls, is normally owned by the system administrator, the system admin. But when we run ls, it can only access files we can normally access. It looks like I'm probably out of time. Final follow-up questions? Yes?
So set user ID, if I have a program that is marked set user ID and a program that is not marked set user ID, do we say that the one that is marked set user ID is more powerful because that allows other users to use the program? Or what exactly do you mean by enforcing more operations?
So the program that's marked set user ID allows someone executing it to potentially do things that they couldn't do normally. Yeah, so they have access to things that they wouldn't normally have. Because it runs as a user ID, they can't normally run code in us.
But user ID 0 doesn't have the same
operation. But user ID 0, still has the same access.
And if user ID 0 starts something, but then it's owned by somebody else, how is that possible?
How is it possible for user ID to start something that's owned by someone else? Just like when you run ls, ls is not owned by you. User ID 0 can run programs that aren't owned by user ID 0. User ID 1 can't start a program that's owned by user ID 2. No, you can run, if it's executable in the access control list, you can run it. It doesn't run as a different user ID unless it's a user ID. It runs as the same user ID all your programs run as, but you can run it if it's executable. Okay. So set out of time. See you. So quiz final next week. I will put the 2021 link up on the study material site right after this. Also post these notes.